The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. A lot to share. We're going to give you the latest on seaweed and why it's important for you. A person named Joe Palermo wrote me a note about cell phone towers, and he's an engineer working in the field, so he has some interesting insights. Also, new information on how cell phones may be contributing to autism as a primary cause. My guest in the second part of our program is Dr. Bruce Levine, and we're going to talk about investigating the causes behind the American public's powerlessness to stand up for their best democratic interests and battle the corporate and political elite. We're doing absolutely nothing. Look around the world. Look in the Middle East. Look in the Far East. Look in China. China had over 100,000 riots by people, its citizens, last year alone. That's in 1 year. We had zero. So we're going to take a look at our apathy. And then some commentaries, short commentaries, one from Ralph Nader, that gives you an understanding on credit unions, why they're more important than banks. And we heard all about how the Rupert Murdoch gang was spying on people. But what about the United States government illegally spying on people and the British government spying on people? It's called Echelon. Nothing is being done about it. We'll talk about that as well. Let's begin. This is from Mainstream Science. This is from Science Daily, and this is from the American Cancer Society's Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry, and here's what it says. Seaweed as a rich new source of heart-helping food ingredients. It says that in an article that may bring smiles to the faces, quote, of vegetarians who consume no dairy products and vegans who consume no animal-based foods, scientists have identified seaweed as a rich new potential source of heart-healthy food ingredients. Seaweed and other macroalgae could rival milk products as a source of those so-called bioactive peptides. And then this is, went on to talk about all the good ingredients. Well, of course, all you had to do is go back and read Protein for Vegetarians, which I wrote 25 years ago, and you'll see that seaweed has 10 times more calcium and magnesium per try weight than dairy. So, interesting how long it took them, quarter of a century, to get around to knowing what we already have been applying and knew a long time ago. Green tea. We should be consuming it daily. It's really important for us. This is the latest from what is called a meta-analysis. Meta means multiple studies. And this was published in the current American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. It shows that green tea has very beneficial cardiovascular benefits. This is from the Chinese Academy of Medical Sciences and the Peking Union Medical College in Beijing. It said 14 randomized placebo-controlled studies evaluated green tea or an extract on cholesterol levels. What they found was that the green tea was able to substantially lower the high cholesterol, and especially to lower the bad LDL cholesterol, and that was substantial. So if you want to help lower your cholesterol levels, green tea will do it. And also, it was shown in another study, also reviewed by Science Daily, that caffeine consumption will cause women to become infertile. And how does it do that? It's simple. Caffeine reduces muscle activity in the fallopian tubes that carry eggs from a woman's ovaries to her womb. This is what they say, quote, our experiments with the findings go a long way towards explaining why drinking caffeinated drinks can reduce a woman's chance of becoming pregnant. And of course, one of the very first things I do when counseling infertile women is to get them off caffeine. And without exception, they've all been on caffeine, but were never told there was a problem with it. From Frontiers of Psychology, a major study shows that patients who use antidepressants are more likely to suffer relapse. This is from Science Daily, and this is from McMaster's University. It says, patients who use antidepressants are much more likely to suffer relapses of major depression than those who use no medications at all. And this was a meta-analysis. And so that meant many different studies. So in lay language, what does this mean for people listening? It means that almost everything you've been told about depression is wrong. You've been told that it's a brain chemical imbalance. There's never been a study or scientific finding in the world to prove that. None. But you'll see the ads on television, and it tries to give you the impression that there is a chemical imbalance between dopamine and serotonin. And hence the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors are what will balance out your brain chemistry. But those are lies. And if you listen carefully, or if you have something that will stop in mid-frame, you'll see that what they're actually saying is, we believe. They're not saying that it's definite, but you're given the impression by the images and the chart they put up there and a picture of the brain that it is a definite. It's not. There is no scientific evidence whatsoever that depression is due to a brain chemical imbalance, nor is there any way of detecting that. It's all complete nonsense made up by the pharmaceutical industry. Therefore, when you start taking these antidepressants, another group of studies showed that a sugar pill, just taking a cube of sugar, will be as effective, the placebo effect. But you're not likely to kill yourself with a cube of sugar each day, but suicide is a very possible outcome of taking these. And I film parents whose children committed suicide. They were completely normal. One guy broke up with his girlfriend, and he was a little depressed for a couple days. So his mother got him to a psychiatrist who got him on Paxil, and 2 weeks later she came home and he was hanging in the bedroom. He killed himself. Then there was a testimony before Congress, and all these families came. All their kids have been normal, and they got on these psychiatric meds and killed themselves. The manufacturers take no responsibility. The FDA, one of the most corrupt organizations in the world, takes no responsibility. The physicians giving it take no responsibility. It's as if this nobody wants to take responsibility for just bad science, bad medical practice, bad public health policy. But it's official. So once it's official, it cannot change. That's why even after something is found not to work and is actually bad for you, it generally takes up to 30 years to stop it. 30 years. That would be like you realizing you're going off a cliff and you begin to put the brakes on, but it takes you 300 miles before you finally come to a stop. That's how bad medicine is today. Next up. So, the conclusion is that since you're going to feel worse and relapse if you take meds, and a placebo works just as well, then just take a placebo, and you won't relapse, and you won't feel bad. Over half of Alzheimer's cases may be preventable. This was an interesting study that I read. It was done at the VA Medical Center in San Francisco. Quote, over half of all Alzheimer's disease cases could potentially be prevented through lifestyle changes and treatment or preventive choices. Well, we know this to be the case because it's quite simple. We know what causes Alzheimer's. There's no mystery. It's inflammation. And what causes inflammation? Simple. Hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, coffee, fried food, bagels. That's what causes inflammation. And chemicals from our environment, like pesticides. and alcohol is way up at the top of the list. Even just moderate social drinking is enough to destroy enough brain cells, and in time, you end up developing Alzheimer's. So we know we can prevent this. Now, here's the good news. We also know now we can revert it back and get a person back into normal. We can grow new brain cells, new neurons, new dendrites. So much we can do to undo the damage. But it takes a more holistic approach. But at least mainstream science is acknowledging what they used to say was purely genetic. And before it was genetic, it was, we don't know why people get Alzheimer's, but there's nothing you can do to prevent it. If you just happen to be one of those unlucky ones, and you start thinking, gee whiz, you know, what if I'm one of those unlucky ones? What has nothing to do with genetics, nor has anything to do with being an unlucky one. It has to do with cause and effect. What you do creates an effect. It's that simple. Natural chemicals found in grapes can protect against Alzheimer's. This is from the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, as reported from the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. And here's what it says. This is from Science Daily. Researchers at Mount Sinai School of Medicine have found that grape seed polyphenols, natural antioxidants, may prevent the development or delay the progression of Alzheimer's disease. This is the first study to evaluate the ability of grape-derived polyphenols to prevent the generation of a specific form of B-amyloid peptide, a substance in the brain long known to cause neurotoxicity associated with Alzheimer's disease. In partnership with a team at the University of Minnesota, they studied grape seed polyphenolic extracts. And this is where they came up with this. There is a woman you've heard her on the radio many times. For those of you who've been in our health support group, you've heard her, you've seen her. Her name is Marie McGovern. When I put her on a protocol, she was at the end stage of her Alzheimer's. And today she is just a vibrantly normal, healthy person with her mental faculty substantially in place. Polyphenolic compounds were a very important part of this protocol. Flooding the body with antioxidants 8 times a day. Juicing all day long. All forms of the quercetin and natural probiotics. This person was taking probably upwards of 60 different supplements a day, all of which were working synergistically. But the juicing and the compounding powders were crucial to helping to get rid of the amyloid plaque. No different than the plaque in your arteries that we've shown repeatedly can be got rid of over a period of time through natural chelation, so too can the amyloid plaque in the brain be broken down and removed from the body, and hence allowing normal biological activity in the brain. So it's not as if this was the first study, because prior to this, we've had people who've made major improvements with Alzheimer's through lifestyle modification. Oh, and Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis as well. I'm Gary Nall. We're here to talk about the things that make a difference in our lives. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone? I'm Gary Nall. Our issue of the day comes from Sherwood Ross from Global Research. And it's short, but I think it's very important, and I'll share this with you. It says, as eavesdroppers go, next Uncle Sam and John Bull Rupert Murdoch and the moral force behind Fox News is an amateur. That's because a global eavesdropping scheme being run today by the United States and Great Britain dwarfs anything that Rupert Murdoch's editors at News of the World ever dared attempt. British Prime Minister David Cameron may well deny he knew about what they were doing with phone taps and tapping members of the royal family and those of American 9/11 victims, but he cannot claim he doesn't know his country is a partner in Echelon, which, according to Washington journalist Bill Bloom, is, quote, a network of massive, highly automated interception stations that is eavesdropping illegally on the entire world. It's like a mammoth vacuum cleaner in the sky. The National Security Agency sucks it all up. Home phone, office phone, cellular phone, email, fax, telex, satellite transmissions, fiber optic communications traffic, microwave links, voice, text images that are captured by satellites continuously orbiting the Earth and then processed by high-powered computers. This is according to Bloom in his book Rogue State. Calling it the greatest invasion of privacy ever, Bloom says that the ceaseless illegal spy system sucks up perhaps billions of messages every day, including those of prime ministers, the Secretary General of the UN, the Pope, embassies, Amnesty International, Christian Aid, and transnational corporations. And Bloom also said that during the countdown to its invasion of Iraq in 2003, the U.S. listened in on all the conversations of the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and the UN weapons inspectors in Iraq and all members of the UN Security Council when they were deliberating about what action to take, plus all top people in Iraq. Now, launched in the 1970s to spy on Soviet satellite communications, the National Security Agency and its junior partners in Canada, Britain, Australia, and New Zealand operate Echelon, which is a network of massive, highly automated interception stations covering the globe. We, the American taxpayer, pay for it. Today, Ed Miliband, leader of the Labour opposition, is blasting Prime Minister Cameron on grounds that, according to the New York Times, the recent scandals in British life were caused by a lack of accountability among those in high places. You know, well, that's true, but what about the accountability for spying on the whole world and all the people in Britain and all the people in every country? How does anything Rupert Murdoch has done or his company as a crime begin to compare with Echelon, an organ of the U.S. government spying on the Secretary General of the United Nations or the Pope, or stealing as it has confidential business information and passing along to favored friends in different companies? I'll say this for Murdoch. He's closed down his biggest newspaper. He's fired top editors and reporters for their part in the scandal. He's gone before the public and begged forgiveness. By contrast, what have high U.S. officials done about the crimes committed with Echelon? Zip. Nothing. And they have no announced plans to do so. They continue to operate this illegal Echelon unashamedly. That's from Sherwood Ross. Now, your thoughts on this. Oh, and did we forget this? By acknowledging that Echelon was monitoring every conversation of weapons inspectors in Iraq, of Saddam's entire regime's level people, then that would have shown that they knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction. Because the weapons inspectors were saying, there are no weapons, there's no chemical biological warfare labs, there's nothing. And Saddam Hussein's own generals and people would have been claiming the same thing. They're about to invade us based upon trumped up false pretenses. We have none of this. Why is it no one is focused on the fact that we would have known all this and therefore would have known that the war was wrong, it was illegal, and went ahead with it? That, if that is presented, and if those information in those tapes are gotten, that would prove that all the people engaged, all the neocons, in planning the war in Iraq did so with the intent of committing a crime against humanity. Your thoughts on this, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, that's our issue segment, your chance to call in and share your comments. We'll go into our studio now and say hello to Elizabeth and to Val. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary.
By the way, before you do, I got this interesting little letter. It says, Dear Gary, a nice, calm, and respectable lady went into the pharmacy, walked up to the pharmacist, and looked straight in his eyes and said, I'd like to buy some cyanide. And the pharmacist asked, Why in the world do you need cyanide? And the lady replied, I need it to poison my husband. And the pharmacist's eyes got big and he explained, Lord have mercy, I can't give you cyanide to kill your husband. That's against the law. I'll lose my license. They'll throw us both in jail. All kinds of bad things will happen. Absolutely not. You cannot have any cyanide. The lady reached into her purse and pulled out a picture of her husband in bed with a pharmacist's wife. The pharmacist looked at the picture and replied, You didn't tell me you had a prescription.
Excellent.
Now, on your end, what do you have?
Right. Thank you. Yes, we have a gentleman emailed into us. He says he's a baby boomer. He's listened to Progressive Radio for some time. And as a baby boomer, he says that he admits that he's of the generation he's refused to be responsible for the choices he's made. Lots of them around him now are approaching retirement, and it scares them. They refuse to look at their own mortality, or they have done until now. He's at an age where historically people have died. They've had nothing to look forward to in the later part of their lives because they have no more achievements that they've made. But he heard you once say that everything has an expiry date, everything. Could you please give a more comprehensive discussion about this today, because it's even more pressing for him and his friends?
Are you familiar with the Russian activist who was in a gulag, Alexander Solzhenitsyn?
Yes.
Okay. When imagining what it was like to live in Siberia under brutal conditions, well, those are the only conditions men in Russia know how to treat each other, and women in particular, extraordinarily misogynist, a group. He said, when you have robbed a man of everything, he is no longer in your power. He is free again. Think of that for a moment.
Yeah.
Now also imagine an old Italian proverb. After the game, the king and the pawn go into the same box. If you were to open a coffin and look in, would you know whether the person was a king or a pawn?
No. No.
Would they both have the same significance at that moment?
Yes.
Now put these two things together. On the one hand, we deny our own mortality. We deny the expiration dates. Therefore, everything in our life we assume will last forever. Our relationships, till death do us part, but rarely is that the case. We'll work here forever. Now that's not the case anywhere. That this beautiful sunset will never be blighted by pollution until it is. That there won't be a hurricane, a tornado, ocean rising, mudslides, flooding, drought until it happens. But it didn't happen before. Yes. And you assume that everything in life would be sustainable based upon the idyllic fantasies and notions of how you want it to be. Planted in the psyche of many people is a highly romanticized illusion of what should be, but it never can be and can never be sustained. So one day a person wakes up and they realize they've reached their expiration date. And what do they have to show for it? Are they happy or not? Healthy or not? Do they have quality friends and relationships or not? Have they achieved anything that they could have shared with others to have at least established the legacy of commitment to some higher ideal on a spiritual level? Or have they just lived for their own, everyone's here to make me feel good about myself, and if anyone doesn't, then I'll blame them, I'll scorn them. have we used other people, manipulated people to get what we need, and then when we finally got what we need, realized that, gee whiz, how many people did we alienate in the process? Very few people who are successful today can say that the people who they used in the process of becoming successful appreciate the person. So where does that bring us? It brings us to stopping for a moment and then saying, but I'm ready now for the next passage in my life, and I will not approach this passage with being afraid of losing my image, my success, my loved ones. I am not afraid of being replaced, because a lot of those fears that we have each day are permanent. They're accumulated early in life, so we never stop overachieving, overdoing, over-responsible. Think of how many mothers are making the beds and doing the laundry and cleaning the rooms of grown children. They fear that they will be looked at as less motherly or less loving or less responsible if they said, now it's time for you to do this for yourself. What if you looked at the new passage in your life as not what you can accumulate in this passage, but rather what you will give? And then ask yourself, at this moment in my life, what is central as a meaning to my life? Or do you even have a meaning to your life? We can see by reality television that the meaning is what a person has, what they possess, and that's all that's important. But that's superficial. What do you sacrifice to find meaning? What's missing in your life? And how does that missing piece affect you? And so what we're really looking at when we want to start over at any age, 40, 30, 50, 60, is we want to change the things that we've been living through as illusion into something far more dynamic as just simply life reality. No more excuses that distort our values, distort our emotions. Most people live too small a life. They have been intentionally confined. They do not seek the expressions that would allow them to be far more engaging, far more curious, far more exploratory. They have been told they only have one reality, and that's the reality that they have been conditioned to accept as connected to them. So now we want to have a whole big makeover. And so I want people to see their future not just as a series of projects with restraints. I think you should look at everything and ask, does what I'm looking at mirror me? And if it does, what does that tell me about me? But frequently we don't want to see the ugly part of ourselves in the mirror. And hence, we don't want to see the consequences of our actions. We don't want to know what it's like to be on the other end of verbal berating by another person, because we would know we wouldn't feel good if someone verbally berated us, or being relegated in insignificance because you're not wealthy enough, famous enough, powerful enough to be considered significant. Just remember, everything this man chooses will mirror his needs. So what needs are he trying to satisfy? And are these authentic needs? Are these conditioned needs? So that's where he should start his journey. He should change by realizing that there are expiration dates, and therefore look at everything he's going to do every day as a gift and take nothing for granted. He should also remember his dreams and expand on them. He should also realize that his earlier life he has outgrown, and it's way past time to change. He should not look at social networks as some sanctuary. These are superficial, foppish, completely illusionary connections. He should not allow any crisis in his life to distort his perception of who he is and why his life is still authentic, no matter what times he's going through that are trying and what crisis he's faced with. And he also should understand what allusions to happiness or security he has used and drop these illusions and deal with life as it is and stop clinging to everything. Have him relocate his repressed energy and have him put love into motion and see what happens. And that's how I would approach it.
Okay, thank you. And can I just, what would you say for those people that are actually frankly scared of dying and they're scared of their loved ones dying?
Every day we are all dying at some level. As a result, we have to be honest about our own mortality. And therefore, instead of looking at death from fear, look at life with appreciation. Death is inevitable. Life should be something that we put our energy into. If we do not fear life, we will not fear death. Those who fear life will always fear death.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much.
And we also have in the studio, we have Jason and we have Val. Hi, Val.
Hey, Gary.
Val, want to mention something for the people in this audience listening to us on this station and over the internet. Finally, we can announce to the individuals that we have our grand premiere of the new film, Knocking on the Devil's Door, Our Deadly Nuclear Legacy. Everything from challenging the safety of mammograms and airport security screening devices and those chest x-rays and colon x-rays and CAT scans and nuclear power and the danger of nuclear power, the lies of the industry and its spokespersons and politicians. Everything that you need to know about nuclear is in this full feature film. And we are sold out for some of the showings, but the showings that are not yet sold out, but will be, because every time we premiere a film, it gets sold out. Even with 1,000 seats, we sell it out. But we have Sunday, Monday, and I believe Tuesday that are not yet sold out.
Right, and there's a few seats left in the evening on the 11th.
Okay, give us the particulars.
All right. It's going to be seen at the IFC Theater, and that's on the Avenue of the Americas at 4th Street. That's the 4th Street subway. And it will be showing at 4:20 in the afternoon, the matinee at 4:20, and at 8 o'clock in the evening. And that's the 5th of August, Friday, and Gary's going to be at that.
No, that's sold out.
That's sold out, but that's where he's going to be.
Afternoon and evening are both sold out.
Right, and that's the 5th and 6th. But the other days, the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th, there still are seats available.
But not many. Now, here's what we're going to do. You're going to come to the film. We're going to have a showing, then a Q&A afterwards. Plus, you're going to receive two full copies of the film itself. One you can keep for yourself and one you can give to friends. This is a very moving film. It's a powerful film. There's never been a film on nuclear radiation like this. We believe that this film has enough of the information necessary to cause a movement to stop going forward on nuclear expansion in America and actually close Indian Point, which is only 22 miles north of New York City. We believe it's necessary to close Indian Point for several reasons, not the least of which it's on a earthquake fault. Secondly, it could be susceptible to a terrorist attack. Thirdly, and what is most concerning to me, is that when the next year to a year and 2 or 3 months from now, when the next solar flare occurs, that wave-like plasma from the sun, which normally would be dissipated by the magnetic shield around the Earth, but now there's a hole 5 times wider than the planet Earth, it's going to hit the Earth. Now, when it hits the Earth, if there's not surge protectors at every single substation and major station and transformer, those will be burned out. That means that all of New York City will be without power. Without power means no television, no radio, no computer, nothing. Zero. No elevator, no gas, no water, no flushing of toilets, all those require electricity off a pump. So that is bad enough. I mean, that will cause people a great deal of suffering. But what happens if it also knocks out the power at the electrical plant, which it will? The backup generators can only last about 3 or 4 days, 5 at the most, and then 59 hours after that, you have a major meltdown like Fukushima. You won't know about it. If we're out of power for a month or two, which is entirely possible, because there's no warehouse where a backup 100-ton generator is waiting to be installed. And these are made in China, and there's the 3-year waiting list as we speak. So it's a very serious situation, and NASA scientists have already discussed this. So that's my big concern, that if those go down, you're going to have everyone hit with radiation and just millions and millions of dead people and a city that can never be lived in, cars that can never be gotten into. It'll be total Chernobyl, but much worse. So all the more reason that you should become aware of the truth of Fukushima, the truth of what we've done in our own nuclear arsenal, our nuclear power plants, 104 of them, and why we've been lied to at every moment. This is a film you will not want to miss. So this is your opportunity to call our office to get your ticket, and then get at you when you come to the theater, you'll get 2 copies of the film plus a sheet of all the organizations that will be proactive. We can't ship this to anyone. The films cannot be shipped because it's qualifying for the Academy Award, and that would disqualify us. So you have to come to the movie theater, but you can come. We're sold out on Friday and Saturday, but you can come Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday to the matinee or evening show. Here's our number to call in. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Again, we're going to sell this out today. All my lectures, everything I do is always sold out, and I don't want people not to be able to come and not get a copy of the film, because this is empowering, it's enlightening, and allows you a chance to do something really positive. So call and get your film. The film... come to this to the premiere at the Theater in New York at 6th Avenue and 3rd Street. And again, there'll be a discussion after each showing. 877-627-5065, and you'll receive $80 worth of film, 2 feature film, when you leave the theater. So that's that. And anything to add to that?
Yeah, I just urge everyone to see the film. I think it's one of the best documentaries you've done, Gary, and I believe it's going to motivate everyone who sees it to change the course of our nuclear history, and we really need to do that. Our whole social structure is just about to be radiated out of existence. So go and see it.
I agree. Thank you very much. Again, call 877-627-5065. Now... we haven't offered a special in 2 weeks, so I'm going to give you one of the very best. This is for people who'd like to get as much in one product as humanly possible. It's a gigantic 5-pound jar, delicious tasting super chocolate. This is a high quality protein, 26 grams of quality protein, raw, all natural, gluten free, dairy free, soy free. And it's loaded with nutrients because I tried to put some of everything else in this so that if you could only use one thing, this would be it. And this is only $99, and you're saving $90. So you're getting an enormous, this package normally be $190. You're paying only $99. Here's what you're getting. Aside from the vitamins and minerals, you're getting brown rice protein, hemp protein, and pea protein, flaxseed, maca root, which is a superstar, chlorella, sunflower powder, canola powder, acai powder, red tea, green tea, black tea, white tea, spirulina, lipase, protease, cellulase. You're getting NADH, Lohan Quo fruit. No one else has it I know of. Lactobacillus, 8 billion probiotics. So this is the ultimate all-in-one product. It's 5 pounds. It's humongous. It's the biggest product I've ever made, and it took me years to get it because I wanted to get 3 servings of fruits and vegetables. I wanted it to be all-powerful role. This has got everything in it, all right? So you've got almost 8 billion probiotics, so you've got your good probiotics. You've got all your polyphenols from all the different teas. You've got all the different green vegetables and the best sources, so you're getting 2 to 3 full servings of fruits and vegetables per serving. You're getting the best quality protein I know of in the world that's all non-genetically engineered, and you're getting high fiber, 15 grams fiber. It's got everything in it. So this is it. And you're also getting a free copy of How to Live Forever, the new DVD. So that, all for $99. It's never been this low. It won't be again. The special is for today only. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. And ask for your super muscle. That's what it's called, super muscle. 877-627-5065. We're going to say hello to Jason and go to our guest. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good.
So we have a great opportunity here, Gary Knowles. We have an opportunity for a social media marketer. We need someone who can really help us expand the Progressive Radio Network. Within the last 2 months, we've grown incredible, and we really need to take it to that next level. So we're looking for someone who's great with computers, who knows how to market to different places to get us out there and let everyone know about us.
Okay, well, good. Give me your number.
646-926-5428. 646-926-5428.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, Gary.
Good. And back in a moment with my guest, Dr. Bruce Levine, talking about why Americans are not using the power of boycott, the power of demonstration. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you from all over the world. I'm Gary Knoll. Joining me on the line right now from Cincinnati, Ohio is Dr. Bruce Levine. He is a clinical psychologist in Cincinnati. He's an activist, author, and dealing with societal problems in our corporate healthcare system. He's a regular contributor to Z Magazine, Alternet, and his recent book, Get Up, Stand Up, United Populace, Energizing the Defeated and Battling the Corporate Elite. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me back on, Gary.
Today, from Raw Story, there is this headline, Anger at Government Highest 19 Years, New Poll. I'll quote this. Dissatisfaction and anger with the federal government are at a nearly 20-year high, according to the results of an ABC Washington Post poll. When asked how they felt about the federal government, 80% of poll respondents said they felt dissatisfied or even angry about the work the government is doing. And this is the worst poll against the government since 1992 under George Bush's leadership. So when you consider that people are angry and so many Americans are out of work and so many are working at low-paying jobs, so many people are sick, and we're seeing enormous waste and favoritism and corporate greed, and then suddenly we hear about the 100 million strong, primarily younger people, who are rebelling in 22 Arab nations. We hear about Indonesia and the fighting in the streets there. We hear about them taking to the streets to rebel against their government's austerity programs and feeding the banks money instead of feeding people in Greece, in Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Italy. And then it comes to America. And we don't have any protests against the hungry children, 19 million, or the 30 million Americans who've been thrown out of their homes, or the joblessness, or offshoring of jobs, or corruption. It's as if we can't get Americans focused. And I want you to take us uninterrupted. I'll just keep quiet, listen to you. I'm going to hear your overview and then go into the specifics. It has to be something on a very primal psychological level that is keeping us from addressing any of our issues. We're in denial about global warming and the consequences of all these catastrophes in the environment. We're in denial about obesity and diabetes and other diseases that are easily preventable. We're in denial about the over-medication and drugging of our children. 10 million children under the age of 18 are now on medications each day. Never before has that happened. We're in denial about both parties being really of one mind, corporate. We're in denial about everything. Why? The forum is yours.
Well, there are some things, as you mentioned, that we're in denial of, but there's actually some things that we are actually aware of. Polls show that the vast majority of Americans oppose these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, over 65% latest polls. Vast majority of people oppose these corporate bailouts, and there is issue after issue where Americans know enough to oppose things. And so what I was really interested in, Gary, was why the heck aren't we doing anything about it? And trying to move past this idea that truth alone is going to set us free, which is a very attractive idea to those of us who are authors, those of us who are lecturers, those of us in the media. If only we could break through the corporate media, that alone will be enough to kind of set people free if they only know the truth. But from my experience, that's not the truth. And the American people resemble a lot more to me people who I see, for example, in individual counseling, individual therapy over the last 25 years, who know, for example, that they've been in an abusive relationship, say with a spouse. They know that nobody has to tell them that they've been getting exploited, that they've been getting verbally, emotionally, sexually abused. Nobody has to tell them that, but they still don't get out. And so they've moved into a kind of abuse syndrome and a kind of a learned helplessness. And one of the interesting things for me was to kind of take a look at, well, how has that happened? And it turns out that there's many aspects of our culture and society has created this kind of powerlessness, this learned helplessness. And I go through 12 major areas in Get Up, Stand Up. And that's what I wanted to do, is understand, map it out so that we could be empowered by what we can do about it on an everyday basis, that we don't have to wait for these national elections, which in some ways, the way they're rigged and bought by money in America, that's one more way people learned helplessness, learned powerlessness. And I can go through that a little bit, but to go through all these different democracy battlefields, all these areas of our lives culturally and institutionally, from our schools to our workplace to my own mental health profession, where the corporatocracy, this combination, this partnership between these too big to fail corporations, corporate collaborating politicians, and the outrageously wealthy elite have kind of governed us and moved us into this kind of a powerlessness and helplessness. How has it played out? So then therefore, what could we do about it? And it's not going to be just enough for us to understand how it's happened. It's not even going to be enough for us to understand strategies and tactics to transform ourselves, which I go through in detail and Get Up, Stand Up. I wanted people to become aware again of what people who have been oppressed have done strategically and tactically to create democratic movements. So that's real important for people to know. But unless we get back what I call our energy to do battle, our morale, we're not going to do anything about what we know. And so that was an important part of Get Up, Stand Up, to kind of get all of those pieces together.
Could you go through some of these in detail now?
Well, some of the ways that some of the spokes on the wheel that we have learned powerlessness, let's just focus on the areas for young people for now, because that really concerns me, because as you were talking about in your introduction, Gary, that in a lot of these places around the world, and historically in America, it has been young people who have been at the forefront of democratic movements, because young people don't have family responsibilities, and they're more willing to kind of take the risks required for democratic movements. And we saw that in our country, in our own own revolution. We saw that in the underground movement. We saw that in the great labor strikes, sit-down strikes in the 1930s, and in the boycotts, civil rights activism in the 60s. So this is important that young people be active and energized. And when you have a society like America that has pacified, subdued young people, that's especially scary. And so I just want to go through a few of those areas, because we can do something about that. We can fight these battles these are battlefields to be fought every day in every way. And one of the great battlefields in terms of that subdued young people is our whole school system, which historically has become a place that people learn much more about obedience than they learn any kind of education. I mean, in a real education system for democracy, folks would be getting more curious, not less curious. In our system, kids come in, and we have studies that show that they're more interested in reading independently when they're in first and second grade, and they lose their interest by fourth and fifth grade. And now with these No Child Left Behind and all these Race to the Top standardized testing, you're going to have even a more fear-based school system, fear for parents, for teachers, for administrators, everybody frightened that if they don't pass these standardized tests, they're going to lose their schools, lose their funding. And you don't have democracy based education in a fear-based system, because in a fear-based system, you don't gain curiosity, you don't learn critical thinking, you don't question authority, you don't decide, you don't learn which is an illegitimate authority and which needs to be resisted. All of those are real democracy education, and so we never had that here in American compulsory schooling, and we're going to have even less and less of that. But what's gotten even worse in American sort of school educational system is that now, as kids are being increasingly shamed for not going to college, okay, they're being called losers. At the same time, we've created an economic system that people who are very intelligent but not academics believe that there's no economic place for them, unlike 150 years ago, where a very intelligent young people had farming and lots of other places for them to go. So now we're shaming everybody to go to college. At the same time, we are jacking up tuitions enormously. So the rate of inflation among college tuitions is even higher than the rate of inflation in healthcare. It's outrageous. And we're also withdrawing government support, unlike the rest of the world, like in many of those Arab nations that you talked about in your introduction, where there is all these young people resisting. They don't have student loans. There's college tuition in the Arab world, and most of the rest of the world is free. And so that is a huge kind of pacifying force when you've saddled young people, very young in life, in their 20s and their 30s, with this outrageous amount of debt. Two-thirds of people in America who graduate public universities have debt, significant debt, and on average about $25,000, but many, many young people have close to $100,000 in debt. And this was unheard of 30 years ago in America, where people, and I know you're broadcasting from New York City there, many people my age remember when the City University of New York, great colleges with great professors, Brooklyn College, Queens College, CCNY, they were free, completely free, which is like the way the rest of the world still is, much of the rest of the world anyways. And also back in that era in the 60s and 70s, you had lots of state universities, not just in New York and California, Michigan, other places which were very low cost. And so most people did not walk around with these outrageous student debt. And so student debt is another area that has really killed people's spirit of resistance. And then we move to another whole area for young people that you've alluded to, which is the whole mental health profession, which is my profession, which has increasingly become a great embarrassment as we're taking more and more of the most potentially activist, democratic kind of anti-authoritarian young people, and we are pathologizing them, psychopathologizing them with diagnoses like oppositional defiant disorder, and we are medicating them. And I've done a lot of work on that, written a lot of articles on this outrageous thing that started basically in the 1980s with the DSM-3. The DSM is the American Psychiatric Association's Bible of Diagnoses. And in 1980, not so ironically, coincidentally with Ronald Reagan's election and Americans' move to a more authoritarian society, we had a more authoritarian American Psychiatric Association introducing all of these pathologies for resistant young people, and the most famous one now has become this oppositional defiant disorder, which the symptoms are often argues with adults, often refuses to comply with adults, this sort of thing. And if you take a look at almost every famous American activist, from Saul Alinsky to Emma Goldman to Malcolm X, almost every one of them would be classified today with oppositional defiant disorder, and increasingly they would be put on medication, because one of the other things that's happened in American society is the whole anti-Semitism psychotic industry, which 25 years ago was a chump change industry. Almost nobody ever got these things like Thorazine and Haldol. You have to be acting incredibly bizarrely to get them. But nowadays, they are used as chill pills for non-psychotic conditions. And now antipsychotic drugs are the largest class of grossing class of drugs in America, with $16 billion last year. So these are drugs like Zyprexa, Risperdal, and increasingly they are being used, of course, to get those kind of numbers. They're not just used on people with diagnoses of psychosis. They're used as chill pills for these kids with disruptive disorders such as oppositional defiant disorders. So we see that. That actually occurs with kids across the board, but more so with Medicaid kids. More so with kids who don't have that much money, but middle class, upper middle class kids are being subjected to these chill pills as well. So those are three big areas that are subduing and pacifying young people, but there's many other areas as well, Gary.
I appreciate those overviews. Now let's take a look at going beyond that, because even when Martin Luther King or the people you were talking about, Saul or Malcolm X, they still didn't have the majority of the people behind them. I was in Haight-Ashbury and Woodstock and the Columbia student demonstrations. I helped put on a political theater at the Beacon Theater with Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland and Peter Boyle. I'm fully aware of how few people actually at any given time in American history ever participated by being a part of demonstrations. They were aware, and many people would say, yeah, I support that cause. Okay, well, how many women said they support a women's initiative and a women's equal rights amendment, but never voted for it, even to this day, when the majority of voters are women, and there's still none of this that has fully emancipated women's rights? So I'm looking at this slightly differently. I'm saying that as a nation, we have a lot of people who are aware enough of an issue, but still find every excuse not to give time and energy to it, and even fewer willing to risk being a focus of administration or some authoritarian energy, like not being out there in the demonstrations. We have a very large audience, Bruce. I mean, it's humongous. And yet, when calling for demonstrations, you would be surprised how few people actually come. Everyone's got an excuse, but very few will show up. Why? Well, what is it that we're afraid of in our society that's keeping us from taking back our government, taking back the power that the people then should use constructively instead of giving it to the worst people? And also, my second part of this is, how is it that some of the really disturbed personalities, the megalomaniacs, the psychopaths, run for office and we vote for them fully aware that these people could care less about us and their voting record shows that they don't honor their word, and yet we continue to think that these are the only ones available, and we don't even look at a third-party candidate, even when there's a Ralph Nader or someone who is much better than anyone else who's available. Your thoughts, please.
Okay, the first issue of why, why are we so passive? And I think we have become increasingly passive in America, but one of the things I think we need to kind of keep in mind is that not too long ago, even in the 1970s, there were working people in this country who had enough guts, enough courage to not only strike against the management, they were striking against their own unresponsive union leadership. It was called the Wildcat Strike. My family, I was part of that. I'm a union family. And so my family participated in these Wildcat Strikes. It's unheard of today. I mean, and so, there's been a part of what happens in American society is the more that you're socialized to American culture, and I talked about some of the ways, there's lots of other things in terms of consumerism, and there's terms of a lot of other things, the way we break union movements, and a lot of other ways we become pacified, but that we become more passive in America. But if you see whether it was first generation or new immigrants who came over in the labor movement, or more recently, take a look at 2006 when Latinos, who are many of them immigrants, many of them undocumented, illegal, many of them first generation, who were least socialized to American pacifying forces, they hit the streets when the U.S. House of Representatives passed the draconian law crackdown against illegal immigration. They hit the streets, 500,000 in L.A. alone, all around America, huge rallies, and they actually intimidated the U.S. Senate from voting on one of these laws that was sort of akin to the Fugitive Slave Act of the 1850s, and they won that battle. So that's one thing to keep in mind. The other thing to keep in mind is there have been significant protests early on. One of the real interesting things for me, Gary, is taking a look at these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. As these wars were actually more unpopular, I mean, as these wars were actually they become more unpopular, there's been less resistance. So, for example, some folks might remember, especially folks in your New York audience are going to remember, in February 2003, there was over 500,000 people protesting against that war in Iraq. And this was at a time when actually the majority of the American people slightly favored it because they had bought into, a lot of them had bought into the lies of weapons and mass destruction, and some of them had even bought into the bigger lies of Saddam Hussein and bin Laden being allies, which was a total lie at the time. But enough people bought into it, so the wars were still slightly favored by slightly a majority of Americans. But there were huge rallies, and even bigger rallies, I should say, in around the rest of the world. So if you took a look at London or Italy or Spain, I mean, there's just gigantic millions of people out there on the streets. But what happened? Well, one of the things that, in terms of why people are pacified, so they realized the governments couldn't care less. The governments are completely unresponsive because you're not their constituency. Voters are not these politicians' constituency. The constituency they care about are the people who are throwing money at them. So I think that made people feel pretty helpless, pretty powerless. And one of the things that I go through in Get Up Stand Up is to have people understand tactically and strategically when demonstrations will work, when they make any kind of sense, and when they won't. And if you're not costing these people gigantic amounts of money, which is what happened in Egypt. I mean, it wasn't just these people protesting on the streets. So these basically young people in the whole country shut it down. I mean, so large corporations and rich people weren't making money, and that's what they care about. And so that's one of the things that people have to think about when you're just demonstrating against government and you're not losing these giant corporations who basically own government any money, they don't care. And so there's certain kinds of tactics and strategies people have to begin to recognize, as opposed to moving into just learned helplessness and hopelessness. So that's one part of, one answer to your question. I mean, the other part you're talking about, why do people still take seriously these sociopathic, idiot politicians who clearly don't care about them? And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. First of all, a lot of people don't. The good news is, from my point of view, is that a lot of people don't take the whole pseudo-democratic Republican process very seriously. They don't show up, even for president, 40-50%, as much as they're being hyped and promoted and propagandized that they're a lousy citizen if they don't go out and vote for one of these schlemiels. They don't take it seriously. That's people like the late George Carlin, had a lot of fans, and it was because that's what he preached, and so they understood that. And people also understand that as much as they would like to, they support. And you take a look at, say, the Green Party you mentioned, and most Americans actually support all Green Party policies. They support. They oppose these wars. They oppose the Patriot Act. They oppose, issue after issue, that they really are more like for the populist kind of Green Party. But they realize that in America, money buys things, and the money buys media, and the media can basically make anybody look like a lunatic if they want to. And if you don't throw enough money at the media, which guys like Ralph Nader didn't, or even a more progressive Democrat like Howard Dean, they were a little bit worried about him, so they made him look like a nut. They can make everyone they want look like a nut, except for the real nuts out there. And so that's part of the problem. But also part of the problem is that when you got a beaten down, a helpless, sort of hopeless society, they lose some of their critical thinking. And you saw this what happened with Barack Obama running in 2008, that people are so beaten down by all those years of George W. Bush and feeling so so tyrannized by these senseless wars and corporate bailouts and on that they just were able to kind of get mesmerized by this charismatic, likable guy called Barack Obama, and really weren't listening to what the guy had to say, because if they listened to what they had to say, this guy was actually in favor of jacking up the military-industrial industrial complex, and he actually came through on his promises. He said he was going to spend more money, and he did. And he was in favor of nuclear power, and he was in favor of so-called clean coal, and he was a dream come true for the energy industrial complex. And he was in favor of a lot of these things that were helped all these industrial complexes, but they weren't listening because they were beaten down. So that's part of the answer there.
I really appreciate your insights. We're out of time. Bruce Levine, thank you very much. I look forward to our next conversation.
Sure, Gary. Good to talk to you.
His books, Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populace, Energizing the Defeated and Battling the Corporate Elite. The website, brucelevine.com. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.
The Gary Nall Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Tabenfeld.